This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 135. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
And you can call us on
020-88-167-691.
My name's David Hinchliff, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. I want to talk a little bit this week about sledging, because it's a topic that we've been discussing on pitchvision.com this week. And it's always one of those topics which seems to polarise opinion around, you know, sometimes it's, you know, against the spirit of the game, and other people say, well, it's, you know, it's part of the game, you can't separate the two, and it's not really against it anyway. And there's a big debate there, but it definitely goes on. So I think my question really around that is, how early can you start teaching players how to deal with that kind of Steve Waugh used to call mental disintegration?
Going back to academy, I know all the academies in England and all over the world would be teaching tactics and strategies is what you want to deal with people saying things to you. And, you know, the reason why they're saying to you is to get your focus away from actually what's important, which is the ball if you're batting, for example, or the ball that you have in your hand when you're bowling. So there are lots of strategies. And what I like about the way that modern coaching is going is that the sports psychologists who have got a number of these strategies that they've researched over time and now getting practically involved and getting the coaches practically involved in delivering sessions that test people, and then you review and you video it and then you go back and people can get better and better at it. The fact being, though, the interesting one is there's probably less sledging as such at international level than there is at club level. So it's almost more important that players get used to it at club level, because you're under so much scrutiny in the international game. And you come under so much flack if you get called out, whereas, you know, there's no cameras, there's no stump mics, there's none of that going on in club cricket. It lends itself to sledging. So, you know, the senior game, the international game, you don't see so much. And when it does come along, you find that it's actually a sort of performance deterrent as much as anything else. We looked at England the other day, and England got very frustrated out bowling in England in India in that second ODI, and started to chirp and chat and do all of that, and their performance went downhill. So, you know, international level, it doesn't really make a massive difference. And I know Steve Waugh was good at it, but against really good players, I don't think it has a massive effect, because they find a way of blocking it out.
Berners, can you remember the first time you got sledged?
I get sledged a lot by my own team, actually. Probably when I think that my early memories playing for a side down in Devon called Exmouth, and I was called into the first team as a fielder, stood at cover, and I dropped a young Jacques Rudolph, who was playing for Paignton Cricket Club, who went on to score 119 that day. And as I walked out to bat with my partner, I was probably coming in about number nine, and I think the batsman was Nick Folland, ex-Somerset and Devon captain. He said, "You've only got 119 to score until you're level here today." I thought, that's a fantastic welcome. Thanks for that, Folly, and we'll see how we get on. So, yeah, it all started internally, and then, yeah, well, all the hallmarks of what Mark spoke about in the club game here in London, you know, we've got certain teams where it literally takes one ball and it all just kicks off. It's like the OK Corral. But I think often the thing that people don't take into consideration is there's a very fine line between sledging a player, which is almost a tactical figure of speech, and just general all-out abuse, which is, you know, calling them names and saying things which have no relevance to anything that's on the ballpark. And that's where the buck stops for me. I'm afraid if someone's going to be a moron, then I'm going to react. But if someone's got a friendly bit of banter and a comment, I'm all for joining in. And as long as I don't knock my teeth out in the car park, then good for it.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I've played in games a little bit like that, where there's so much going on and so many people talking all at the same time that you even if you wanted to listen to it, you couldn't. It's just too much. It just becomes chatter. So you don't have, it becomes completely ineffective because you literally can't listen to it, you know, because everybody is around, especially, you know, if you're trying to save a game and there's people around the bat and everybody's talking at the same time, you just stand there and go, oh, listen, I can't understand what any of you saying because you're all talking at the same time. Yeah. One at a time, please, boys. At least I can understand you then.
It's definitely more effective when there is an actual need for it. If you've got someone who's struggling or the game scenario, you know, calls for something a little bit more than what the ball or the bat can actually provide, then, you know, that's fair enough. But just doing it for the sake of it, I don't really see the point of it. It's, you know, certainly no great fun to hear someone using the C and the F word all afternoon.
But going a little bit back to the point I was trying to make initially, which is... if you're thinking about a coach who's, you know, a club coach who's got, you know, maybe under 14s, under 15s, under 16s, you know, that kind of age group. Gareth, do you think that kind of age group is the time to start putting those strategies for dealing with sledging into the minds of batsmen at that age?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't call it. I wouldn't say it was a strategy against for sledging. I think what you need to do at that sort of age is to start and build up an understanding of the here and now and what's important. And, you know, and it could be sledging, for example, somebody having a go at you. It could be, you know, your mum just coming in to watch the game can be a distraction as well. And all I try and do with my players that I work with at young ages is just make them aware that the only thing that's important in a game of cricket is that moment that you are in then. And so many people future project and look forward, and so many people dwell on what's gone on in the past, and that can be anything. And if you nail the now, you go pretty well. End of story. If you concentrate in that moment, at that given moment, everything's on that bit of concentration of that ball, you're not going to go too far wrong. And that's a good strategy when you're dealing with whatever, coming up to milestones, going past milestones, getting close to targets, somebody sledging you from slip. Just concentrate on the here and now. Keep your routines nice and consistent and just nail what you've got ahead of you. And you know, it doesn't matter whether it's sledging or anything else.
That's great advice. How do you teach somebody to do that if they're struggling with that, if they are getting distracted, if there's someone, you know, some 40-year-old who's standing in the slips and he's a canny customer, he knows exactly what to say to get under the skin of somebody. How do you get that out of your head?
The two best tactics are to breathe, because whenever anybody's under pressure or distracted, they forget to breathe and don't use their breathing well enough, and that instantly gets the body under control. And the second thing is to smile. And if you smile, the muscles in your face often reflect what's going on in your body as well. So it can have a reverse effect, and you can actually control your physiology through your smile. So those are the two bits of advice that I would give anybody who's under pressure in any circumstance, is to get in control of your breathing. And we did something at Somerset in 2005 when we played 2020 cricket, because it's high octane, it's lots of running between the wickets, it's lots of energy. We taught all the players how to belly breathe, so to take more oxygen in by breathing through their bellies rather than through their chests. All right, so it's a simple thing to do, and there's a lot of things out on the internet that you can read up on about belly breathing and centering that enables you to get yourself back into that moment, get your physiology under control.
What do you think, Berners? Start breathing and score more runs?
Anything could help, and I've definitely taken that advice on, Gareth. I tell you that next year's my year, mate. You're going to see a lot from me next year.
Just learn to breathe, mate. Always helps.
Yeah. We have to pay to breathe in London these days, though. It's an expensive game.
It's not like living in the sticks, is it? Everything costs money there.
You got a card for it. I think you have to top up every week, and you're allowed 364 breaths a day. That's your limit.
Talking about controversial things in the club game, overseas player is another thing that we've been talking about recently. You've played against people like Jack Rudolph, you were mentioning earlier, Berners. What's that like to come up against overseas players who are, you know, big fishes in small ponds?
Yeah, it's really good. Well, often at the time that you're playing against them, they're not quite what they are now, because they're often young guys who have come over to spend the off-season, as lots of pommies do. They go down under or they go to South Africa and play grade cricket. I think it's magnificent. I originate from Devon, and down there, every side in the Premier League and probably the first three divisions are very reliant on getting a player of what they hope is higher ability that kind of, you know, brings the club together and gives them a kind of focal point. And we've played against some magnificent players that have gone on from down there. I mean, one side had Stuart McGill and Jacques Rudolph, and even JP Dumini played for my side when he was at Western Province as a young 18-year-old. And, you know, that you can see there are clear, there's a clear gulf in class, and you rely quite heavily on them, certainly in those leagues down there, to kind of perform. But, you know, you definitely learn if you're a bowler and you're a good club bowler, and then suddenly you've got a guy that's coming in playing maybe in a different style, and he's a little bit more kind of attack minded, which they often are. You've got to change your game and think. So I think it's great for club cricket that these guys come over and play. Other people, you know, might suggest differently, that they can often hog, you know, a young player's position in the team, or, you know, the whole game revolves around them, and that just comes down to man management and how their role in the team is perceived and placed, I guess.
What do you think, Gareth? Overseas players in the club game, good or bad?
Very good, full stop. And the key thing is to get a good one. And I don't just mean in terms of getting the best player. The whole idea of an overseas player is to play games, to win you games that you probably wouldn't do, but equally to show everybody else how to win those games. And an interesting one for me is Waringstown had a lad playing for him, a South African lad who's in the South African A set up at the moment this year up in Northern Ireland. And it was the way he went about his cricket that was the important thing, because he actually got taken out by South Africa halfway through the season, yet Waringstown went on to win two trophies. And they went on to win it because of the things that he'd instilled within them, the confidence that he'd instilled within them, but also the processes. You know, the processes of hitting the ball hard out to the deep fielders instead of trying to fiddle the ball was a massive thing for them. You know, the confidence to be able to clear the ropes at any given moment in time. And those are the things that your overseas player leaves behind. That's the legacy stuff. And if you get the good guy come in, not just in terms of scoring your 1,000 runs and getting your 50 wickets or whatever, but if you get a good person coming in, your club will talk about that person for year on year on year on year, because it's a legacy piece.
Okay, now it's time on the show to catch up with Gary Palmer. He's continuing with his interview with us, and this week we learn a little bit more about coaching batting. Let's go back to that buy-in, because when you're working with professionals, you don't get a chance to work with them day to day. You come in for a sort of a fixing session, if you like.
Yeah.
How do you build a rapport up with a player quickly so you can get that buy-in?
They're definitely very difficult for me to give you a structured answer on that. For me, I suppose it's experience. I've worked with quite a lot of different types of players and people, and you sort of get a feel for how you're going to work with somebody. But the bigger the professional cricketer, the sort of bigger the name, then I think you've got to let them have a bat, just assess what they're doing, and just softly start feeding in a few little points and monitor their body language and their reaction to what you're saying. And if you think, you know, it's going nicely and they're listening, then you may feed some more in. And if it keeps working, you just keep going. And that's how I would go about doing that. And with a professional cricketer, I would ask, you know, how does that feel? What are your thoughts on that? You'd ask them questions. But the way I coach is very much tell, because of the environment that I'm in, but it's how you tell. You know, you've got to just find that nice balanced way of saying what you want to say without getting someone's back up, and then listening to what they're I like problem solving with the player. You know, is there a particular area you can't hit the ball? Okay, so let's see if we can do that. How are we going to go about doing it? You might want to try this. So they try it. How does that feel? I feel okay. That feels good. Well, let's now do this. You can't be too regimental and sort of sergeant major with a sort of big name player like you can probably with a young academy player. A young academy player is just going to listen to your every word and do it generally. With a big name player, it's a little bit more touchy feely. But I still personally, the way I would like to operate is more of a tell and problem solve way with that player. But you must be seen to be listening to what they're saying. But sometimes with a very experienced player, you can make the mistake of asking them, and then suddenly that player will start going into quite a long conversation in detail, and to the point where you think, hang on, this is turning around now, and they're starting to tell me what they know about coaching. And it's not really about that. It's about me as a coach trying to cut to the chase and sort this player out. And sometimes the more you let them speak, the more they believe in what they're doing is actually right when it may be wrong. So you've got to sort of monitor that and think, okay, let's sort of nip this in the bud here and get back on the machine and put some balls in. But for me, if your first session with a player, you can improve that player quite a bit. You can demonstrate that you can do that. You give them all the benefits. I always think you must tell a player. If you want to tell a player to change something, there's no point saying change it because I said so. You've got to have a good reason to change it. Right? If a bloke's getting out a particular way or can't hit a particular area, then you need to step in and make change. And you've got to show the benefits of that change. You hear a lot of people saying you cannot change a technique in the middle of a cricket season. Now, I would strongly disagree with that, because if a player has a problem and they're not scoring any runs, you can't just leave them doing what they're doing. You need to step in and make a change. And if it's the correct change that's going to make batting easy, then there's only a positive that's going to come out of that. There's not going to be a negative. If you leave them alone, they're going to get worse and their performance is going to go down, and that may lead to them being dropped. Now, I think a really good coach is someone who's got their eye on their players all the time. And even when that player is doing well, that coach can see a flaw developing to the point where they step in, nip it in the bud before that player suddenly has two or three bad scores. I think that is brave, and that is good coaching. You can't just leave somebody alone, and you know, I don't understand that. I think you've got to nip in and make the change, fix them. It's like a car. Something wrong with the car, goes to the garage, put it right, goes back out, fine. You don't leave it chugging along with the blinking petrol injectors all clogged. You clean them out and you make it better. I think it's lack of confidence in the coach sometimes if you're going to not make a change with a player. And if you know what you're doing and you believe in what you're doing, that player will feel those vibes come from you. And I think he'll be quite happy to make a positive change.
Time now for the question section on the show. And as you know, every week, if you send in a question, you get a chance to win a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So Berners has got the questions this week. What's in the mailbag, Berners?
Okay, we've got a player here, Josh, 16 years old. He's a big fan of Ian Pont, who, of course, is an elite-level fast bowling coach, and he's been researching all aspects of the game during the off-season here, from the shoulder-hip separation, the arm pull, chest drive, and so on and so forth. He's got 3 months till the start of the season now, and he's determined to break into his school first team. He's got a heavily structured training session that he's going to put into place with a couple of friends throughout the winter. And he just wants to try and make a difference using the kind of biomechanically sound advice that Ian often offers people. So he's just asking you, coach, what kind of things can you advise him to get the most out of the training sessions that he can do to apply towards his fast bowling?
Well, my thoughts on the second part of that question, which is injury prevention, I don't want to hurt myself, is there's a couple of things that you can do to make sure that doesn't happen. Keep an eye on how much you're bowling, and particularly on the type of surface that you're bowling on, because it makes a difference whether you're bowling on grass or whether you're bowling on a very hard concrete indoor surface. You want to try and minimize the impact as much as you can on surfaces like that, which helps and it also helps to have a strength and conditioning program that makes sure that it covers strengthening up the areas of your body and also mobilizing the areas of your body that are required for fast bowling. So As a very, very quick overview, you want to have mobile ankles, you want to have strong knees, you want to have mobile hips, you want to have a strong core, you want to have a mobile glenohumeral joint, which is the joint that's just a lot of work around your shoulders, and you want to have a generally strong upper back. Because if you work on those particular areas, then the rest of it will kind of fall into place naturally anyway. And the other part of making sure that you are preventing injury is to make sure that your hips and shoulders are well aligned. You haven't got one of those nasty mixed actions. But even if you haven't, you definitely want to make sure that you're not over bowling yourself, because it's been well proven that once you cross a certain threshold with the amount of bowling you're doing, especially as a teenager, your chances of injury go up quite a lot. So keep an eye on how much you're bowling and try and stay as much as possible within the ECB directives for how many overs you should be bowling. What was the first part of it? Oh, yeah. The best methods to train to ensure that I get the most out of my training. What do you think about that, Gareth? Is there any general advice you can give on a keen youngster who's training with his friends?
Yeah, I think, again, it goes back to those workloads, doesn't it? And the ECB directives are well proven. They've been researched significantly. And if they're followed in line with the stuff that Ian Ponce has put forward in his courses, that this lad has obviously studied significantly, then if you can put the bowling quota together, the numbers together, appropriate numbers with some good technical stuff, and that's great. The other thing that I would say is be monitored, because working with your friends is great, but we all know what happens when we work with friends. We get a little bit competitive with them, and when competition comes into play, then technique can sometimes break down because you're looking at outcome-based stuff. So it's always good to have somebody keeping an eye on you, or get somebody to video you every now and again, so you've got some sort of benchmarking process to see whether everything is working in the way that you want it. But what a great starting point. He understands the Ian Ponce work. He's a big fan of Ian Ponce work, which is all very biomechanically based, which is great. As long as he puts the bowling quotas through the ECB directives alongside and has that benchmarking process through video and through somebody else watching him, then he's going to put himself in a good stead, really.
Now, just as a side issue around those ECB directives, which we do highly recommend for all bowlers, of course, because they're well researched. But there is a lot of huffing and puffing around older players, because I think it goes up to under 19s now, doesn't it, for those directives? And there's certainly I've heard some huffing and puffing at club level about guys who are 18 and 19 and they have to be pulled off from bowling in club games when they're bowling well, because you know, they've reached the threshold when, you know, they're essentially, they're fully grown men. So I suppose a limitation of any of these directives, because they're general, there's going to be outliers, there's going to be people who don't fall into that. But what do you think about that, Gareth? Do you think is there any other way of doing it, and you just have to, the people who are outliers and the ones who aren't going to get injured because, you know, they're exceptions, just have to put up with being lumped in with the rest?
Yeah, I can see the argument, and you know, the regulations are there to cover all cricket, aren't they? And yet you've got players, and we had it at first class level, where a young bowler would come in and would be 17, 18 years of age, been on professional programs since the age of 13, and yet would need to be stopped from bowling after 7 overs. You know, and obviously in Championship cricket, that was quite hard work because there's a lot of overs to get in during a day. But, you know, they're there to be adhered to. I understand that people moan and groan about it, but the bottom line is that people don't really stop growing until they're 21. You know, that's where it all finishes off pretty much. And we have to respect that. And, you know, these regulations that are put in place for a reason. It's not just a group of people coming up with an idea. It's heavily researched. And I know that Kevin Shine and his guys up at Loughborough have put a significant amount of work into it. And that's why it will always get my backing.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the other thing these days is that people are generally less active. You know, you're playing your formal sports, but, you know, there's generally less activity throughout a day. You know, you spend time sitting in front of computers, sitting in cars, etc., etc. So you've got to bear all those things in mind. You've got to bear those wider things in mind as well as just what you're doing on the cricket pitch. So, yeah, overall, I think I agree with you. And unfortunately, you're just going to have to put up with it if you're 16 and 17 and you feel like maybe you should be bowling more but you can't. Well, you know, it's better to be safe than sorry, isn't it?
There's plenty of time to make up your overs during the rest of your career, and if you're doing that off of a good foundation of not having stress fractures and all of those things, then all the better. And I've played a lot of cricket with a lot of guys that got injured in between the ages of 15 and 18, and it always catches up with them. And the guys nowadays that are being cleaned throughout and being looked after by the regulations, you know, are going to have a much longer and more fruitful opportunity to be able to bowl at top pace for a longer period of time.
Okay, we've got the old classic here, 16-year-old top order batsman. He's very confident in his own ability and his technique. However, he's constantly getting very low scores, and might often suffer from that issue as well. Tends to face a lot of balls, so he's saying that he faces between, on average, 60 to 150 balls, but only gets a score of around 15. So not really turning that around with great efficiency. And he's just saying that he's in the nets. He finds it very easy to score, but finds it a little bit harder in games when the pressure is on. So his coach is currently continually commenting that his batting is good. However, he just can't make that big score. So he's just wondering about a little bit of advice from you. Should he be a bit more aggressive? And what kind of things can he do to add to his confidence?
What do you think of that one?
Well, there's an interesting saying that England are churning out on a regular basis, which is find a way. And this lad's obviously got a good understanding of technique. He's talked about his coaches saying that he's playing well. And it takes me back a little bit to Ian Bell in 2006-07 out in Australia. And technically, he, as he is now, is fantastic. And what Duncan Fletcher asked him to do was to walk down the wicket early on, get across his stumps, and find a way of opening up a gap on the leg side to get him off. So every single first ball that Belly faced against the likes of McGrath and Bickle and, you know, Brett Lee, he would walk down the wicket and he'd just tuck it off of his hip or off of his pads into the leg side and get himself going. And he used his own body momentum. He didn't change anything about his technique. He used his technique to his fullness. But instead of just standing there and letting the ball come to him and then playing everything in a technical fashion, he used his technique further up the wicket. And I think it's a really good way of helping technically good players access different areas of the cricket pitch, because you can still play good technical shots, but from different areas on the 22 yards and get the ball into. So that would be my advice, would be to use your technique positively by moving yourself down the pitch, taking the ball earlier and knocking it particularly leg side, because one day in cricket in particular is leg side game because there's less fielders over there.
Absolutely. I'd also add to that it's important that you know your own game, so you know that when you do get a ball, which is something that you can put away, you don't worry about what's gone on before, you don't think about what's going to happen next. You know, if you get a half volley outside off stump and you've got a decent cover drive, then you just put it away, and you know that then you can focus on the next ball. So if you know what your strong areas are, and if you've got a decent technique, you're going to have at least a couple of shots where you know you can get some runs. Then you can start to score more quickly just by having that, as you said, Gareth, just by having that intent. And I think there's a difference between an intent to score runs and being aggressive.
Yeah, definitely.
Because if you're being aggressive, then you know the it's a bit more of a panic. You think, right, I've got to pop this one in. Over Cow Corner because I haven't scored a run for two overs. It's not necessarily the case. You don't want to go from 0 to 100 miles an hour. You want to tick along a little bit more than that. So yeah, having the intent to score those runs is really important. And then going back to the idea of saying to yourself, right, I've got these areas where I'm going, where I know that I can score runs. And everyone's different. You know, some people have got a great cover drive. Some people can work it into the leg side of Jonathan Trott is amazing at working the ball into the leg side. And you need to find those areas that you can score and use them as often as you can. And then I think the other thing is that you need to have confidence in yourself that you've done enough practice that you can score in those areas. And don't worry about the areas that you're weak in. Forget about them. You know, you can work on them in practice if you like, and you should work on them in practice. But when you're out in the middle, just think to yourself, well, I know I've got this shot and this shot and this shot, and I know my areas where I'm going to score, and I back myself to do it, and I'm not going to get myself stuck in a rut and start panicking, you know, if I block out two maidens.
Yeah, I mean, as a general rule, people's strike rates go up over the course of the innings, isn't it? So if you can get better at getting yourself from 0 to 10 in a controlled fashion, and in particular, if you're a good technical player like this player sounds, then that's only going to help, because you are going to pick up the strike rate as you go through, because that's the way that batting happens. So one of the reasons for going down the wicket as well, if you're facing an opening bowler, go down the wicket and playing a good technical shot, is that you bring singles into mid-off and mid-on, which often get missed. And you only have to watch an international game to see how effective people are at picking up singles to mid-off and mid-on in international cricket that in the main you don't see in club cricket. Well, actually, there should be more reason in club cricket, because people don't practice it in the stumps as much as they do in international cricket. So, you know, if you can take 3 or 4 steps down the pitch, punch one to the left or right hand of mid-off, and it's a run every time. And if his lad's a good technical player, then that should be well within his means.
Yeah, and of course you don't have the replays as well. So if it's a tight run thing and you're out by a frame, then the club umpire's going to give you the benefit of the doubt, isn't he? More often than not, as well. So
yeah, absolutely. But you know, if you're already 6 yards down a pitch by the time you've made contact with the ball and you've hit it to a left hand of mid off, then it's going to be one hell of a bit of field, isn't it, to get you run out?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Although, you can sabotage yourself. I remember a game I was playing in where the guy thought that he hadn't come down the pitch. He played a back foot shot. So that was probably the problem.
That's the crunch.
And he hit it to easily our best fielder, who is one of these guys who is just a natural. And he hit it, he said, "Yes, easy one." And he wasn't even in the frame, I don't think, when the stumps went down. So it just goes to show that you've got to think about those things, haven't you? Whether you're on the back or the front foot, or how far down the pitch you are, these things make a difference. If a direct hit, you don't need a camera necessarily. A direct hit, you're usually out, aren't you?
Well, you are, unless you've hit it, you know, off a front foot coming down the wicket in a controlled fashion, and that's what, you know, watch the international game, because what the international game gives you isn't necessarily an indicator of the technique, but it's the hows. So if you've got your technique already, these guys will give you the hows. And what they do fantastically well is find ones. And the amount of ones they get to mid-off and mid-on in one-day international cricket is amazing. And that has to be able to be transferred over into club cricket without any stretch of imagination, that one.
When you're coming down the wicket, when it's a medium pace bowler, just as an interesting aside, I think it's still relevant to the question, though. I mean, I've seen Ian Bell do it, and he walks and kind of stops, doesn't he? He's kind of in position, so his head is still, but he's further down the wicket. Is that the best way to do it? Just kind of, you know, it, almost use it like a trigger, move down the wicket and then be still as the ball's been released?
Yeah, I mean, you don't. The trouble comes when somebody just hairs it down the wicket, and you see sometimes somebody like Afridi do that. And as an opposition team, when Afridi does that, you know you've got half a chance of getting him out, to be brutally honest. But when Bell and Peterson go down the wicket, they go down with a control element to it. As you say, Belly hits from a very still base, whereas KP's still moving, but his head is very, very still. And at point of contact, he's very balanced still. So you know, you want to still be balanced at contact, whether you're coming down the wicket or not. That's one of the key principles of batting, is moving from a balanced position to a balanced position at ball strike. And that's what these guys do. And it makes it easy to control, because then you can hit left hand of mid off or push it wide of extra cover, because you have the control. Whereas if you're on the move, you lack control, and then you're just reliant on the trouble.
And I suppose that's something you have to kind of work out for yourself, whether you do it more in a bell type way, where it's a, you know, it's more of a controlled movement, or you do it in a Peterson type way, where it's the movement is slightly less sort of considered, if you like, but it's, you know, he's still balanced at the key moment. That's something you have to think about and have a little go at before you do it in the middle, right?
Yeah, it is, and I think KP's movement is very considered. I think that he understands it, but there's more momentum going into the ball than when Ian Bell does it,
yeah,
for example. So there is a slight difference, but you know, this is where you again watch a game of cricket and try things out. And I'm a big advocate of people trying things out, because unless you try something, you don't know. So if you are struggling, if you are scoring 15 off 60 balls and you want to get your run rate up, here's an option. Move yourself down the wicket against the quicker bowlers, get ones to deep mid on and mid off and mid on, but also understand that if you go slightly across your stumps, which is what Ian Bell does very well, it also opens up that leg side. And invariably, when you first go in a one-day game of cricket, there's only three people on that leg side, which means that there's gaps, and you can play a straight batted shot into those gaps.
That's all we've got time for this week on the show. But before we go, as we always do, we're going to choose a winner for the competition, which is a online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So, Gareth, who do you think should win the prize this week?
My favourite question from this week was Josh talking about slow scoring. I think that affects a lot of people, and hopefully some of the things that we talked about there will help a number of you out.
Congratulations to you. And if you're listening and you haven't sent in a question and you are thinking to yourself, well, I fancy winning an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy, then you can certainly do so if you send in your question to us. The ways to get in touch with us are many and varied, including our telephone number, which is 0208 816 7691. And Gareth, you know what the email address is, don't you?
Yes, it's coach@pitchvision.com.
You can also get us on Facebook. Do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, and you can find us on Twitter under PV Cricket Coach, where we're hanging out, tweeting there. If you want to find us in iTunes, you can go into iTunes, do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, and subscribe to get the podcast delivered to you every week. And if you don't use iTunes, then you can go to pitchvision.com and find the feed to the show to put into any podcast reader that you like. That's all for this week, so until next time, we'll see you next week. Thanks, Gareth.
Thanks, David.